We're on the third of our crash course in Jewish history, and coincides with Holocaust Memorial Day, Yom HaShoah, which was on Sunday night and Monday, yesterday. And so I'd like to speak about our last installment of 1300 years, which is really up until the modern period, the Middle Ages and the modern period. And I'd like to speak about it in terms of the Holocaust. And the question, if some of you saw the title, was, is the Holocaust the end of the Middle Ages, and kind of like the leading Middle Ages leading towards the Holocaust, or, and this is somewhat provocative, is it the culmination of modernity? Okay? And we'll see why this question is so poignant, because it has aspects of both. Thank you. So, in terms of understanding the Middle Ages, unfortunately, the Middle Ages is really a whole sequence of Jewish displacement, anti-Semitism, terrible persecution. At the same time, it's a period of incredible religious creativity and productivity and flourishing. And we started talking last time about the Talmud, about how when Jerusalem was destroyed, the rabbis gathered, and over the next 130 years, centralized all of Jewish thought and practices into the Mishnah, and then spent the next 200 years explaining it in the Talmud, in the Gemara, which is the corpus of the Talmud. And if you ask, you know, how did Jews survive 2,000 years without a state, which is really unparalleled? In the 1980s, the Dalai Lama requested a group of 15 rabbis to visit him in India, where he was in exile from Nepal, and when the Chinese persecuted religion, then they fled. And he wanted to know from rabbis, what is your secret of survival in the diaspora? And not only do we survive in the diaspora, we survive in the diaspora moving from place to place. And the secret is really the Torah. It was really that, in this question of are we a nation, are we a religion? In a sense, we're both. But what brings us together ultimately was the Torah. And the teachings that were studied in such a dedicated way and became the center of Jewish life. And in the Middle Ages, and there were many other side benefits, of course. In the Middle Ages, Charlemagne, whose French Empire extended over about half of Europe, enlisted Jews to run his empire. Because this is the Dark Ages. Basically, almost everyone was illiterate, except for the monks and the Jews. And the monks, he wasn't going to enlist because there was always a political tension between the monarchy and the church. And so he enlisted the Jews, because we're the only ones who knew how to read and write. We were, you know, the levels of literacy in Jewish society are extremely high. So that is the success story of the last 1,500 years of Jewish history. The success story of Jews, in terms of the general world, will really only come directly in the last 100, 150 years. But for Jews, it really was a success story. And this is despite Jews being expelled from England in 1290, France in 1306 and 1394. I'll explain to you why twice. Hungary between 1349 and 1360. Austria in 1421. Germany between the 1500s and 1400s and 1500s. Lithuania 1445 and 1495. Spain 1492. Portugal 1497. Bohemia and Moravia, 1744. It's crazy. Okay, and a whole other lecture is really the phenomenon of anti-Semitism. But we cannot understand the Middle Ages without understanding the beginnings of Christianity. And last time, which is now 3 weeks ago, we talked about it as well. But I'd just like to sum up what I viewed as the roots of anti-Semitism that were planted in Christianity from its very beginnings, and why there was so much terrible persecution from the Crusades going across Northern Europe in the 1091, the first Crusades, when 5,000 Jews were killed in Speer, Mainz, and Worms, when the whole Jewish community, Ashkenazi community, was some 30,000, okay, to the terrible sufferings of the Spanish Inquisition, and the Inquisition spreading after that till the Chalmeniki massacres in the 1600s, which in which they estimate some 300,000 Jews, perhaps a third of the Jewish population, was killed. And I should also say that in 1967, the Second Vatican Council denounced anti-Semitism and many of the roots of it. We'll talk about that. And yesterday, Yom HaShoah, the day before Yom HaShoah on Sunday, they beatified, they made it to a saint, John Paul XII, and, sorry, John Paul II and John the 12th. John the 12th was the one who actually ratified the Second Vatican Council, and it was approved after his death, but he's the one who pushed it through. And so John Paul II is very famous for visiting the synagogue in Rome for the first time, visiting Israel, and publicly apologizing for the history of Christianity in front of the Western Wall to the Jewish people. So yes, things have changed, fortunately, and I want to preface what I'm going to say by saying that. And the silent pope, which I'll have to talk about, the silence of the world in front of the Holocaust, the silent pope, Pope Pius XII, has not yet been made into a saint. Despite the numerous requests to do so, they're still balking. So that is, in a sense, a positive demonstration for Jewish church relations. However, there are three main elements which we talked about, let me just reiterate them, that built into Christianity the persecution of Jews throughout the Middle Ages. And one sociological, or several sociological phenomena. One is replacement theology. Christianity believes in Mount Sinai, God gave the Torah to the Jewish people, and for some 1,300 years, the Jews had the covenant. Their belief, however, was that Jesus brought a new covenant. The covenant was superseded by a new covenant. That's called replacement theology. The church is the new Israel. The only problem is that Jews were supposed to buy in, right? If this is a new covenant, the people who should most go into it are the people from the old covenant, right? New and improved, right? You want to upgrade. But we didn't. And this created big problems for the church. So what are Jews still doing around? So they had to come up with an explanation. The explanation was that God kept us around in a downtrodden state to show we've been rejected, to have to affirm the new covenant. Okay? So, and that is in a sense a self-fulfilling prophecy. So Christians, the church always made sure that Jews remained downtrodden. So there were laws, Jews could not go into the trade unions. Jews could not own land. Jews could not have non-Jewish servants, which wasn't the biggest issue than the first two were. And this led to the myth of the wandering Jew. Remember, Cain, who killed his brother Abel, was given a curse and a sign and would wander the rest of his life. So you also had the self-fulfilling prophecy and was banished by God. So you see, look, Jews are running all over the place. It shows we have the mark of Cain and are banished by God. Famous poem by Victor Hugo as late as the early 1800s of the wandering Jew. And we read the history of the wandering Jew. However, unfortunately, it was Christian countries kicking us out and persecuting us. But that led to this myth of the wandering Jew, which had to be self-perpetuated. Then, to exacerbate it, was the charge of deicide, that we killed their God. And so not only that, but all Jews are accountable for that act, which was what was denounced in the Second Vatican Council and rejected, that theology. And so you have replacement theology, you have the wandering Jew, and you have the charge of deicide. On top of that, you have the kind of socio-economic phenomenon that Jews were always caught in the middle, right? We were always caught between, we were often the money lenders. Why? Because ironically, in Jewish law, you're not allowed to lend money to a Jew. In Christian law, therefore, in the same Bible, Christians cannot lend money to a Christian. But then they understood that lending money is good for an economy, except when you have junk bonds and subprime mortgages. But generally, it should be good for an economy because it creates more wealth, which then is used to generate more. So Jews were enlisted to do this. Yet, the moneylender is the one who's the collector as well. And Jews were often the tax collectors because, you know, if you're Joe King and you hire Joe Christian to collect taxes, he's got all his buddies whose palms he's greasing and who he's exempting, the Jews, the outsider, bringing the outsider to be the controller. So we were often caught in the middle between the monarchy and the populace. And so this made for a bad brew and for the unfolding. The ghettos did not start really until the 1500s. But Jewish and Christian society were generally living separate. Yes?
Can you say why you can't lend money to other Jews?
It's a biblical commandment. The ultimate,
Because isn't it seen as a hard thing to do for someone?
No, and collect interest by doing it.
Oh,
to do it as a business, excuse me, to do it as a business. In the Torah, it's a mitzvah to lend a Jew money specifically and not charge. So you have the Hebrew Free Loan Society. Every Jewish community has these loan societies where you can get free loans from people. And I'm often approached.
You're talking about interest.
Correct. With interest as business. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Who are the original Christians? Were they Jews?
So the original ones were Jews. This is really our last class. Okay. It's online. You can listen to it. They was originally pitched to Jews. It was a messianic Jewish movement, Jewish messianists, really, like kind of the Jewish messianic churches. But they believed in Jesus as Messiah and very quickly the Son of God. But then when Jews weren't buying, Paul marketed it for non-Jews, got rid of the commandments, no circumcision, no kosher, no Shabbat, made it easy to use Judaism, and spread like wildfire. Okay, so unfortunately by the way, this anecdote of why we were kicked out of France in 1306 and then 1394, we were kicked out in 1306, and then Louis XI, who was Saint Louis, who was beified, realized that there were all these Jews, all these loans were outstanding. So he figured, I'll invite the Jews back, have them collect all the loans, and offer them 20 cents on the dollar if they do so. They came back, collected the loans, got 20 cents on the dollar, and then he kicked us out again. And he got 80 cents on the dollar of these loans. So this is the kind of stuff that went on. And the Spanish Inquisition, it's unfortunately a litany of tragedy throughout Europe. Jews were kicked out of Western Europe. We moved to Eastern Europe, invited in by Poland to understand that Jews were good for the economy. And there's some people of a theory that whenever the Jews were kicked out, the French Empire no longer had its power. We were kicked out of Spain at the golden age of Spain, of the Spanish colonies, and Spain went downhill. Poland realized Jews are good businessmen, have an international network, hard workers, educated, are a good asset for the nation. So that was the history. And so, unfortunately, one can view that the Holocaust was really the culmination of 2,000 years, or 1,500 years of Christian anti-Semitism brewing in host populations. And at our past Passover class, we talked about how in the codes of Jewish law, it said you use red wine for Passover, but in the areas where there are blood libels, accusing Jews of using Christian blood, Passover, use white wine. This is the extent to which it was. And so, and we'll talk about this, that the Holocaust was initiated by Germany, by Hitler, may his name be cursed, and the Nazis, may their men be obliterated, and their final solution. But without the host populations not just complicity, but active involvement, it could not have happened in the way it could not happen. So it was really all of Europe that conspired in the Holocaust. And last night at our NJE Holocaust Memorial, it was Mr. Coulter, right? So he said, he talked about his three children and I think 12 or 9 grandchildren, and his cousins who have, you know, 6 children and 29 grandchildren, and he said, "We won, and Hitler lost. The Third Reich is gone, and the Jewish people are moving." So just remember that as well as we start to talk about the Holocaust. So in some ways, one can view the Holocaust as the final destination of 2,000 years of anti-Semitism fostered by the Catholic Church, okay, in many ways, and the Eastern Orthodox churches as well, and the Protestant Church. You know, Martin Luther was a rabid anti-Semite as well. So that's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it, and now we need to start to talk about modernity. What is modernity? It's hard to define. You can define it technologically with the industrial, with the beginning of, it's the beginning of rational positivism, okay? But you can look at it, the use of reason to understand our world, to dominate our world, and to order our world, and reason being the final arbiter of knowledge. We know Galileo and Copernicus were persecuted by the church for their scientific discoveries, and Judaism never had such scientific witch hunts. In Judaism, we believe science is truth, Torah is truth, and the two, in some level, must be reconciled. Very different approach. And modernity is also the shift, and this is very important, from a theologically based political system, right? The king is divinely appointed, has ultimate rule, and the people are there to serve the king, to a shift to every human being is created in the image of God, and because American democracy is based upon deism as well, and therefore all human beings are equal and have equal rights before the law, and the state is there to promote the rights, to defend the rights of the individual, and to allow them to fulfill their needs of truth, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? So a very different shift. And because of that shift, the big question arose, whereas under monarchies, Jews were always second-class citizens who were limited by not only land and not being professions and all of these things, and then being put in ghettos, not being allowed to live in all different places. Under the Enlightenment, there was a big dilemma. All people are created equal. Jews are people. Therefore, Jews have rights. Now, we know they made some exceptions. You know, if your skin was black, you didn't have rights yet in America for another, close to almost 100 years. So they did make exceptions. But this was hotly debated. And even though Rousseau and particularly Voltaire were extremely anti-Semitic, they nevertheless admitted the fact that Jews would need to be brought into the Republic and be given rights as citizens. And the watershed was, because then the question was, well, can Jews be full citizens of a country, really, because we're not just a religion, it's not that we have another religion, but we're a nation. So Napoleon convened a Sanhedrin, a convention of Jewish leaders, mostly rabbis, and asked them a series of questions. You know, are you French Jews? Are you Jews who happen to live in France? Or are you Jewish Frenchmen? Are you Frenchmen who happen to be of the Jewish religion? And by and large, they answered the latter and started to institute those changes. And really, the question was, we will let you out of the ghettos and bring you in and even give you citizenship if you show that you are good Europeans, good Frenchmen, good British, good whatever it is. And so began the process of assimilation of Jews, adapting to modern life, often at the expense of our Jewish practices. But the synagogue was made to look more like a church. Instead of sitting facing the middle, you put in pews, put in stained glass windows, put in an organ, even proposal to change Shabbat to Sunday, rather than Saturday. Make the prayer book in the vernacular language. And if Jews are accepted in university, you have to be part of an eating club. So it meant you are eating. There goes kosher. Public schools are on Saturdays. Who was just telling us? So it was a gentleman from Argentina when he grew up there. Had school on Saturday, which he was exempted from. I knew someone who grew up in France, and there was school on Saturday, and they were Shomer Shabbat, Sabbath observant. They would walk to school, sit at their desk, not take notes, but they'd go to school. Right. So, but by and large, was the beginning of what we the Reform movement, and which didn't start as an ideological movement. It started as a practical movement to accommodate ourselves to European society. And look, when you had the choice of, you know, either the last 1,500 years of brutality and torture and displacement, or accommodating, you know, the drive was so strong because look at what the alternative was. And there are some Jews who held strong to Jewish life, but in the vast minority. And then there were several seminal moments. Okay, people think, you know, the Holocaust came out of a vacuum, right? Hitler arose, you know, you had the emancipation, assimilation, Jews are part of Europe, we rose to the highest echelons of French society, of English society, a Jew became Prime Minister of England, Jewish background, Disraeli's father converted, but he was Jewish. In the late 1800s, you had the French government, there were very high people, in all areas of life. And yet people think the Holocaust came out of a vacuum, right? Germany suffered after World War I. The country was in desperation. They turned to a right-wing nationalist leader who then arose and drove the country toward to the atrocities committed. And so according to that, he would have been reverting back to the brutality of the Middle Ages, theoretically. However, it's not so simple. And what people miss is that this experiment of Jewish, of emancipation, opening up the ghettos, letting Jews in, assimilation, Jews trying to adapt to become more European and less Jewish, wasn't such a overwhelming success, despite the fact that Jews rose so quickly in society in the highest echelons. And the one event which crystallized that ambiguity was the Dreyfus Trial. Everyone heard of the Dreyfus Trial? Yeah. Albert Dreyfus was a very assimilated Jewish French officer who was accused of passing on spying for Germany in the Franco-Prussian War. And very clearly from the mock trial, it was clear that it wasn't him. The note was found was nowhere near his handwriting, but he was sent to prison in any case. And it became a cause célèbre. Émile Zola, the famous writer, wrote vociferously against what was happening. Families were split. Society was in uproar, but he still went to prison. And there was that event was really just one of a whole wave of reactionary reaction to the emancipation. And there was a wave of anti-Semitism in the late 1800s, 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, 50 years before the Holocaust. That's what we don't realize. And we'll talk next week about the emergence of Zionism. And next week is Yom HaTzimut, Israel Independence Day. So these 2 weeks fell well with, you know, our Jewish history. There was a young assimilated journalist at this trial by the name of Theodor Herzl. And he had a epiphany in his life and about the world that anti-Semitism could never be ridded because Dreyfus was a totally assimilated Jew, loyal to France. And he really realized himself that trying to ignore his Judaism was futile. And he came up with this vision that the only way to stop anti-Semitism is to get the Jews out of Europe. And he began the crusade, which culminated in the Zionist movement, which we'll talk about next week. But what were the reactions of the Jews, most Jews, to this wave of anti-Semitism in the 1880s, 1890s? After all, we played the game, we danced the dance. What more do you want? So there were a number of different reactions. Some, there was a large, even though there had been conversions, there was a new wave of conversions. Some Jews just threw in the towel, said, no matter what we do, no matter how we try to become, to act as European as we can, it's not going to work, so the only thing left to do is to convert. Heinrich Heine, a famous author who was originally Jewish, converted, not for his writing career. He converted for a legal career that he never even practiced in. Moses Mendelssohn's son, Felix Mendelssohn, converted to become a great conductor. And Heine said he was then supported by the Jewish, by the salons, who were mainly Jewish patrons of the arts. And he said, you know, I am, kind of in a self-loathing way, you know, I am now truly, you know, a convert, because I am now being patroned by Jewish arts, our Jewish philanthropists who are supporting my artistic endeavors. So what were the reactions? Conversion, more conversions was one reaction. There was a reaction of what we call Jewish defense groups, okay, which weren't actually physically defending, but B'nai B'rith, which was formed as partially B'nai Jewish defense group, but partially, see, the problem was that Jews wanted to retrench in, either you converted or you retrenched in your Judaism. My uncle, who in the 1930s was beat up every day in school in Austria, wound up putting on tefillin and studying with the rabbi, he told me, because, you know, when you're persecuted, either you have one of two reactions. You say, hey, it's dangerous to be a Jew, so be even less Jewish, or completely not Jewish. Or you say, this is happening to me because I'm Jewish, and Mr. Cutler said this last night, so I'm going to assert my Judaism, because look at all I suffered for, to make you stronger. So, but the problem was that they'd so left Jewish religious life in the synagogue, they couldn't go back. So they formed secular synagogues, or Jewish societies like the B'nai B'rith, where Jews would gather and have somewhere to go, be accepted, but which weren't necessarily religious. Then you had religious reactions. The conservative movement, which we view as being more liberal than Orthodox, was a reaction against Reform to conserve more of traditional Judaism, because they felt Reform had gone too far. Remember in the Cincinnati banquet, Cincinnati Convention of 1891, I think it was, they had the Treif banquet, and I have the menu where they served. They found all the ways to break the kosher laws. Serve lobster and pork and meat with cream sauce, and the conservative felt they'd gone too far. Then you had what was called Neo-Orthodoxy, Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in Germany, which tried to reconcile and say, we will reassert our traditional Judaism and yet learn to be in the modern world and be both at the same time. And so a Jew can be educated and can be part of society, but we'll keep Shabbat, keep kosher, and keep... and this is, in a sense, the beginnings of what became modern Orthodoxy, really. And the other reaction was Zionism, which we started to talk about, get the Jews out of Europe and assert Jewish nationalism. This was the age of nationalism. Countries were going back to their roots. Germany had been united into one country. Italy had been united into one country as late as the 1670s. So now we need a Jewish country and a Jewish symbol. The Magen David, the Star of David, only became the Jewish symbol, really, that late. It was used by Jews, but it wasn't the primary symbol. The menorah had always been the primary symbol. And so the final reaction is isolationism. And so Hasidism said, speak Yiddish and not the host language. Dress differently, assert your difference, and put the ghetto walls back up voluntarily. When the world is rejecting us, so let them be, who cares? Live our lives, put up the walls, and may they be darned. So those were the many reactions to this wave of anti-Semitism. But unfortunately, what we learned is that the first wave of anti-Semitism was just a precursor to what would become then, you know, a downpart turn in the roller coaster, which then would fling itself forward with all the more vehemence. And here we get to the Holocaust. And on Sunday night, I went to hear Elie Wiesel speak. He's actually a member of Fifth Avenue Synagogue, where we run services, run programs. You can go there most Shabbat mornings, and you'll see him there. In fact, this past Shabbat, he read the Haftarah for everyone. He's a congregant. And he got up and he said, "I don't understand." And he's been, for the last 50 years, you know, studying the Holocaust, and the most celebrated Jew, really the most famous Jew in the whole world. One of the individuals in the world recognized as the moral voice of humanity, of society, of civilization. He up and said, "I don't understand." Said, you know, the Holocaust defies all rational explanation, from the psychological to the political to the, you name it. He said, it all goes to the scientific, it all goes against rational and reason. He also said something really poignant, which we'll get back to. He said, in Hungary in 1940, remember, Hungary was the last country to be deported and sent to the death camps. They were only invaded in 1944. He said they did not know about the death camps in Hungary. And he said, "How could we not know? I don't understand it either." But let's just stick with his first point. And this is where we have to look at things. And because the Holocaust came out of the country which represented the greatest achievements of modernity, right? Modern Germany was at the height of science, was at the height of philosophy, was at the height of culture and art and education. It represented the greatest and brightest of Europe. And this is where the Holocaust came out of. And so we have to question, is it the result of 2,000 years of medieval anti-Semitism, or is it a reflection of modernity? And what happens when man is given when the human factor becomes the barometer, becomes the measuring stick for all of man's efforts? In other words, there's no longer any higher morality. And that's why Nietzsche is blamed for the Holocaust. And Nietzsche is not to be blamed directly for the Holocaust. People took his philosophy. God is dead. Man is the measure of all. Power is the barometer, and the Übermensch is the one who will conquer. You know, not that different from Machiavelli and other figures throughout history. But this time, pushing God out of the picture. And so when you just rely upon the age of reason and upon humanity without God, one could argue this is what it leads to. When science, unbridled, is brought to the service of man's unbridled agendas, right? And let's remember that the Nazis had a whole coterie of scientists, psychologists to prove, and genetic theories were all the rage in the late 1800s, right? There were different races, and those races had different racial characteristics, and this was proved by, last night in the slideshow, they showed, you know, they had a measuring, what is it called? Like a slide rule, you know, the width of the Jew's nose. And we probably all know stories. My great uncle fled from Salzburg, from Austria, on a train. They were looking for him. And because he had blonde hair and blue eyes, he succeeded in fleeing to France. So they were looking on the train for him, but they couldn't find him. A Jew can't have blonde hair and blue eyes. It goes against Aryan ideology, which was scientifically proven. Right? So the marshalling of science to the aid of totalitarianism and of brutality. And finally, the mechanization of killing. And this is another point which is made, how the Holocaust in some ways was a reflection of modernity, because when you have the mechanization of killing, the Industrial Revolution, it became another thing to put on the conveyor belt and to maximize productivity through. So from this point of view, one could argue that in a sense, the Holocaust was the climax of modernity and a manifestation of unbridled modernity, and now we live in the postmodern age. Not the age of postmodernism because everything is chaos, but the age of postmodernism because why was there an upswing of religion in the world? And why does one no longer have to really argue the rational arguments against atheism? Because after the Holocaust, people understood this is where modernity leads. Then modernity is no solution either. It doesn't have any easy solutions. And so, if you have modernity in terms of God is dead and man is the measuring stick of all right or wrong, and man's will to power is a self-justified philosophy, and if you have science brought to the service of that unbridled ideology, and then you have productivity brought to that unbridled ideology, you wind up with your Holocaust, even out of the centers of education and art and science and philosophy. The best of modernity. So it went against modernity, and in some ways it was a manifestation of modernity, tragically. So which one is it? Which one is true? Anyone want to weigh in? Is it the culmination of the Middle Ages, Christian anti-Semitism, or is it the culmination of modernity?
Both.
Unfortunately, say both. And so while Nazi Germany was really the outgrowth of that terrible, rotten branch of modernity, Hitler's willing executioners were really the product of, whether it was in the Ukraine, Babi Yar, right, with the first mass grave of 40,000 people, or to, you know, the Hungarian deportation of 600,000 Jews to Auschwitz in the matter of months. That was coming out of medieval Christian anti-Semitism. And there's a big debate in this. Hannah Arendt, and you know, I'm not going to go through the actual history of the Holocaust itself. I easily read the story of it from the West's attempt to appease Hitler, right? Didn't want to cause waves. He took over part of France, okay, that used to be German. Took over Western Czechoslovakia, okay, there. German-speaking Czechs, so that's part of the German homeland, took over Austria, they definitely invited him in. And then Churchill goes to visit Hitler, says, you know, we'll let you keep Czechoslovakia, make nice, and announce peace in our time. And Winston Churchill, who thank God became Prime Minister, he said, what is appeasement? Appeasement is feeding the crocodile so you hope you'll be the last one to be eaten. That's what appeasement is. Okay? And if we say never again, we want to remember the lessons of the Holocaust, and we've all said this Sunday night, we have to remember that in the age of Iran going nuclear. Okay? And what appeasement leads to. Okay? Negotiations, peace in our time, when you're facing evil, evil does not stop. For me, that is the lesson of the Holocaust. And unfortunately, the world hasn't learned it. I think the Jewish people has. I hope Bibi Netanyahu has strongly internalized that message. But the world hasn't, folks. And it's not going to end well. He said the whole world would stand up to them. We saw the sanctions were starting to work. And now just caved in. So a few notable events from the attempts at appeasement of Hitler. The invasion, beginning of the invasion of Eastern Europe, the final solution in 1941, which was implemented and which was conceived and then started to be implemented. And Hannah Arendt wrote her book called The War Against the Jews. And I'm going to pick several themes of the Holocaust. I'm going to pick the theme of the war against the Jews. Why, you know, people say, oh, you Jews, you know, you're always talking about, you know, your persecution complex of the Holocaust. You weren't the only ones killed. Why do you make such a big deal out of it? Or not, maybe not even that, but why do you say, you know, you are the victim? Second point I want to talk about is who is responsible, the banality of evil. Was it a bunch of technocrats and a machine set up? And And then that's the second theme that I want to talk about. And the third one is why did Jews willingly go to their slaughter? These are the three myths or stereotypes, ideas that are presented about the Holocaust, and I'd like to talk about them. So the first one, the war against the Jews. So while it's true that Jews were not the only victims, Elie Wiesel said this, well, Jews were not the only victims, all Jews were victims. Right? In other words, we weren't the only ones who were victims. It's not that all victims were Jews, but all Jews were victims. That's the way he says it. So while it's true, others were persecuted and suffered, but we were focused on as an ethnic group, and what's clear in her book War Against the War of Jews is that Hitler diverted from his war effort to exterminate the Jewish people. And in 1944, when they needed trains to be bringing soldiers to the front, they were bringing Jews to Auschwitz. And so Hitler's two goals of taking over the world for the third, create the thousand-year Third Reich, and exterminating the Jews, the latter was more of a goal for him than the former. That's the first thing to be said. And while not all victims were Jews, all Jews were victims. So that's really the point to make about it. And so we do focus on it because of those two phenomena. Okay. And and so that's why when I start talking about the final solution, that's why the final solution, unfortunately, was so significant. Another watershed period in the war was the Warsaw Ghetto. And in 1939 to early 1940, it took Hitler as long, the Nazis as long, to take the Warsaw Ghetto as it took him to invade Poland. Jews weren't passive victims. We did fight back. Okay. And there are numerous cases of it, from blowing up crematoria to rebellions in concentration camps. However, whether they were Jews or non-Jews, when people were systematically dehumanized, taken step by, remember, Hitler didn't just start killing Jews right off. There were Nuremberg laws, and then there was Kristallnacht, and then there were ghettos. And then there were deportations, and then there were the postcards they were told to write to their relatives, and there were the train tickets they bought, and they were... This was a careful psychological plan. This wasn't a rabid killer who just was on the rampage. I mean, it was, but he did it in a planned, logical manner, which is also has to contribute. The Chelmniki massacres, the Cossacks just swept across and just randomly killed. That wasn't Hitler. That's part of the modernity of it. Right? So,
wait, why is it part of the material?
Because that systematic planning, using logic and reason, a business plan, a whole project, mechanizing it, that's part of modernity.
Did you read the book about IBM providing a computer to the Germans so that they can systematically identify Jews?
So, so the Warsaw Ghetto was one demonstration of Jews not going like sheep to the slaughter. There were some cases where they knew it was inevitable, and they're being funneled through barbed wire with dogs. They could have tried to turn them and shot on the spot, and maybe it would have slowed down the killing machine, but some chose to go with dignity and with their belief, and that could never be taken away. So for some, that was their affirmation of how they were not going to allow Hitler to demean them and to lower them to his level. So, and they went singing Animami, I believe, with perfect faith at times. So you had both reactions. So one can't categorize it that way. That's the second thing. The third question, and this has come to the fore, David Goldhager's book, I guess it's now 5-10 years old, but it was a response to Hannah Arendt, another Eichmann in Jerusalem, talked about the banality of evil and how Eichmann was a small bespectacled bureaucrat who implemented this system. And Germans who are wont to follow systems, people just kind of like followed along, and the banality of evil, and really it was kind of like this machine which drove itself. And the leaders were the ones who were the evil, the SS, and marshaled the rest of the people to kind of like create this system. Our tweet today was Raoul Wallenberg who said, he said that evil, Simon Wiesenfeld, that the possibility of evil comes about through good-natured people not reacting to what is going on. But it's not so simple. And that theory doesn't stand. As David Goldhagen, Harvard professor, wrote in his book, Hitler's Willing Executioners, where he spends, I don't know, some 700 pages, and I have not read it, proving that without the complicity of the rest of Europe, the killing factories could not have happened. And so, someone can't just say the leaders put this in motion and everyone else just stood by passively. Standing by passively did allow it, but it couldn't have happened if you didn't have significant parts of the population who readily were part of it. And France, which is viewed as one of the more benign countries, right? I mean, Italy, Germany had to go in because they simply didn't have it in them to deport their Jews. The few countries that really resisted are, anyone know? Guys, you should all know this. Okay. Denmark, who the king came out with a yellow star on riding on his horse the next day after the law was declared. And we're walking on the street on 72nd Street one day after Shabbat services with the kids. It was very nice. And I come up, hello, you're Jewish. You know I'm from Denmark. My father, he went with the boats and he brought the Jews at night. 6,000 Jews they ferried across. And we said to him, we're so grateful for you. And it's incredible what he did. And he wanted to share that with us. And so he doesn't want to share it. And in one night, they ferried across 6,000 Jews, or three or four nights, across the Channel to Sweden, which was neutral and never invaded. And saved their Jews. The other country which wouldn't deport their Jews was Bulgaria. Also defended their Jews, and Albania to a certain extent. Albanians, the Jews who were ethnic Albanian, who were Albanian, they would not deport. The foreign nationals were deported, but they have a code of hospitality that someone is your neighbor, your host, you're their host, you at all cost, even the danger to you and your family. And they did. They hid a few hundred Jews. As a woman, Irina's a member of our community whose family was saved in Albania, but there was only a very small number. But Bulgaria, there were a number of thousands who they would not deport. France, who was what we view as one of the more benign countries, right? The top north of France was invaded by the Germans, the south was Vichy France, run by French, a government complicit with the Germans. The Germans said, deport the Jewish men, and what did they do? They deported the men, women, and children to show the Germans how loyal they were. This is France. Okay? So, Hitler's willing executioners. That's the story. And the fourth point to make, right? War against the Jews. Jews not being passive, allowing it to happen. Hitler's willing executioners. The fourth point I want to make is as the world stood silent. Okay? And there are books you can read. What's it called? Gosh, you know the names of the book? Of the Western World Not Reacting. There's several books that were written about it. And from, you know, the New York Times burying the stories on the back pages, page 26, while having a front page cover story about Governor Lehman throwing away his rubber tennis shoes when Jewish extermination was on page 26. Showed that in the movie at MJE last night. To the Jewish community itself was split. remember that in the 1930s you had Father Coughlin spouting anti-Semitic venom on the radio. Jews felt their place was very precarious and were frankly afraid. And many Jews felt you can't make waves, you can't speak out too loudly, it's dangerous for us. There were 400 rabbis who did not follow that, marched on Washington, and FDR would not open his office to meet them. The doors remained locked. And there were a few Jews, Peter Bergson, Hillel Cook, who was Rev Cook's nephew, and a playwright named Ben Hecht, who was an assimilated Jew who had his own epiphany and realized what was happening. And they mounted these pageants where they filled Madison Square Garden and they had a show that traveled throughout America, kind of dramatizing the extermination of European Jewry. They took out full-page ads in the New York Times, which many people were against, saying the world is standing silent and Jews are being sent to their slaughter. And the big question, the big question mark is, how could they not bomb the tracks to Auschwitz? They were bombing factories all around there, and they never gave the order to bomb the lines to Auschwitz. And the movie, The Monument Men, which I did not see, but apparently, not just after the war, but in the end of the war, during the whole war, the argument for not bombing the tracks at Auschwitz was, we cannot divert from our war effort to save civilians, because ultimately, if we win the war, we'll save civilians. That was the argument. You cannot divert from the war effort. However, it's been proved that from the refusal to bomb Kyoto, they bombed Nagasaki and Hiroshima instead. Why? Because one of the generals, the head of whichever department it was, had visited Kyoto as a young man and didn't want the artifacts to be destroyed. To earlier decisions in the end of the war to not take certain military actions because of the consideration of art being destroyed. And then the Monument Men, anyone see the movie? Anyone? No one here? I don't know if it actually started during the war, but I think during the war, at the end of the war, they were already sending people, diverting from the war effort to save art, when we argue they couldn't divert from the war effort for civil considerations. You see the stark contrast there. FDR took an isolate. Well, they were helping the British war effort from very early, and the U-boats started sinking American ships because of the land lease, because America was sending England supplies and raw materials. So not totally. I mean, without Pearl Harbor, how long would it have taken to draw America in? I don't know, but not completely, and many ways, FDR, my father, he was the champion of the world from the New Deal to the Second World War. But unfortunately, people begged him to bomb the crematoria. The excuse was, well, you can't kill people. And in Jewish law, it's a big question whether you can take some lives to save other lives on the tracks. There's so much that could have done with so little effort and the world. And the Germans themselves, when they were testing out the final solution, we have their notes saying, the world is silent, Jewish blood is cheap, no problem, we can go ahead with our plan. The Germans were worried about popular opinion and about world opinion. It was a factor in their consideration. Jewish blood, not a peep. And so, how could Elie Wiesel not know about the extermination camps? How could a Hungarian Jew not know? He said, we listened to the BBC. Listen, BBC did not bother reporting about that. It wasn't on their agenda. Jews are being killed. Jews are being killed. That's the reality of it.
When did they find out?
1942. The American government knew about the extermination camps. We know that. document.
And the general population as well? Or?
Yeah, there were Jews who knew by 1943. There was a Rabbi Weissmandel who was sending messages out to Switzerland and from there to America. When the rabbis marched on Washington for late 43, I don't remember when exactly, but they knew. That's what they're marching for. That's what these full-page ads in the Times were for. And equally complicit was the British. We'll talk about this next week with the development of Zionism, the British mandate in Palestine. In 1939, the British write a white paper. No Jews allowed to immigrate into Palestine. For their considerations of, you know, Arab oil and politics. And even you could say, okay, in 1939, things were bad in Europe. There were Nuremberg laws. There was Jews being beat up in the streets. But you could say, okay, well, you know, things are tough, but they've been tough for Jews many years. But 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, the British maintained the same policy, closed to Jews. If they'd only written visas for Jews, Jews could have been saved. Hundreds of thousands. The British actively prevented the saving of hundreds of thousands of Jewish lives. Now, there were righteous Gentiles. England took in 10,000 Jewish children, my mother, one of them. 10,000, pretty decent number, but that was before the war, once the war started, closed. Switzerland let some in, sent some back into the hands of the Germans. There were individuals, and this is another chapter of the Holocaust that has to be spoken about, the righteous Gentiles, Gentiles who risked their lives for Jews, from this fellow Wilson in London, and non-Jews, a businessman who, you know, secreted out, got Jewish orphans out to, what was the name, the Japanese consul Tokovno, Kanasaki, who wrote, who he had yeshiva boys, he couldn't write fast enough. He wrote 3,000 transit visas through Japan and gave them out and saved the Mir Yeshiva and saved the thousands of Jews. I just heard about LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, who was the assistant undersecretary of the Interior and let in illegally 600 Jews into Galveston, Texas and stuck them in a warehouse. To Ruth Gruber, a Jewish photojournalist who petitioned the U.S. Army, the only group exemption made for refugees was 1,000 Jews who were brought to a camp in Oswego in upstate New York. 1,000. And after the war, when they wanted, Truman said to Bevin, the British foreign minister, let Jews into Palestine, 100,000 Jews. What was his answer? You want them in Palestine because you don't want them walking around on Broadway. And there was some truth to that. During the war and even after the war. So, yes, there were righteous Gentiles. To the young Polish priest, who after the war, when a family, Catholic family, came to have their child baptized at 12 years old, which he found peculiar, why they baptized the child at 12 years old. He started eight years old, I think. He started probing and pushing and asking, and they finally fessed up to him and showed him the letter that this was a Jewish child who was entrusted to them. And now that the war was over, their parents hadn't come back to reclaim them. This child they wanted to baptize and just keep as their own as a good Christian. But they had a letter, and the letter was the parents saying, if we don't return, we have relatives in Canada, send the children to Canada. And this young priest said to the family, you cannot baptize this child, you have to try and find their family in Canada, and if they want this these children, then you have to send them to Canada. And that young priest went on to become Pope John Paul II. So yes, you have the story of the righteous Gentiles. You have Gentiles who risked their lives. Would we risk their lives if we lived during the slave underground railroads? Would we risk our lives to help free them? I don't know. I don't know if I would. And they're non-Jews who did. David Popper is a member of our community. His father was there last night, where they were hidden in a barn in Holland for 2 years. His father grew up, didn't see daylight for 2 years as a young teen. These non-Jews were risking their lives. Would have been slaughtered had they been found out. So yes, there were the exceptions. Were there many? No. Do I begrudge that? No. The ones who put their lives in danger. The ones who didn't need to put their lives in danger, the Laika family. They had a whole railroad going where they would take Jews into their employment. Laika was a big asset for the German economy, had stores all over the world. They would bring them into their factory, train them, and then send them to their foreign stores. Hundreds and hundreds of Jews. And the Germans never caught on finally. One of them got put in prison and beat up, but they saved hundreds of Jews. So that story has to be told as well. You know, the one little flicker of light in a sea of darkness. This isn't theology class, although I do have responses to the Holocaust, not for tonight, for another time. And it's really a whole series on why bad things happen to good people and how to understand this. But as Elie Wiesel said, you know, it's in the end, we can look at these different points of, you know, Hitler's willing executioners, the history of Christian anti-Semitism, the use of modernity towards nefarious ends. And by the way, Stalin killed probably 50, 60 million people, more than Hitler, okay? So we know. But ultimately, it's still incomprehensible. You just can't really put your head around it. And just one last historical point that I'd make. The question is this, you know, and you can talk about this in terms of faith after the Holocaust. And there are so many ways in which the Holocaust is unique because of the modernity piece, because of the extent of it. But let me ask you something. And Dostoevsky asked this in Brothers Karamazov when Ivan is debating with his brother. And he said, you know, when does evil become intolerable? When does bad become such that you cannot live with it? 6 million? You know, people ask, where's God after the Holocaust? But on the other hand, Chelmniki massacres in the 1600s, 300,000 Jews were killed. A third of European Jewry. I can live with that, but I can't live with them 3-6 million. Destruction of Jerusalem, Josephus says there were close to 1 million Jews who died in the destruction of Israel and Jerusalem. I can live with 6 million, I can't live with that. And ultimately, Dostoevsky says, one little child suffering, innocent child being killed. Can I live with that? So, it's not a reductio ad absurdum argument. It's something to think about in terms of that piece. But in terms of the uniqueness of Jewish history, there are many ways in which the Holocaust is unique, unfortunately. But one can look at another period of Jewish history, which was the destruction of Jerusalem. And not because of Jerusalem, but because of the temple. When Jerusalem was destroyed in the year 70, and the temple was destroyed, Jews were not sure, would this whole enterprise continue? Can we live without Jerusalem, without the temple? So there had been other periods in Jewish history where it appeared like, you know, the Jewish enterprise of 3,300 years, is this, have we come to our end? And what was unique about the Holocaust is that we could have been exterminated as a people. Besides all the unique aspects we just talked about in terms of the culmination of anti-Semitism, the modernity of it, and all of this. But we could have been exterminated as a people. And when Rommel was going across North Africa, there was a danger of Palestine being overrun, the 500,000 Jews who lived there as well. And then what would have been left? American Jewry, some of Russian Jewry, some of South American Jewry. So, historically, that's where we're at. And I'll reiterate Mr. Cutler's words that the Third Reich is no more. And yet, here we are. And really as an affirmation of the strength of the spirit. And of course, the British and American and Allied sword was needed. Okay, we can't ignore that. And that's why Israel needs the strength of the spirit and the strength of the sword. And next week, in our final installation of our crash course in Jewish history, instead of doing 1,300 years, each session, we have the luxury of doing some 100 years of the history of modern Zionism, the birth, miracle of the birth of the State of Israel, and Israel until today, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and the Israel-Arab conflict. So that'll be our final installment in our saga of Jewish history before we get to our upcoming events. Any questions? Yes? Speak up a little bit, please.
Part of the modern history is how we make sure we can prevent this from going forward. How we prevent this from happening.
Well, I spoke about here. Does that? I mean, I spoke about the appeasement before the war. What's his name? He's in our time. Not Churchill. What's his name? The British Prime Minister before Churchill.
Chamberlain.
Peace in our time. The appeasement is, you know, feeding the alligator so that you're the last one eaten. For me, that's a lesson of what I see the world doing with Iran, trying to appease them and just feeding them. And evil does not stop. Recognize that evil is evil, and you don't, you know, Obama came into office and said, we're going to extend them a hand of friendship. And they slapped him in the face. He's still trying. The belief that goodwill will engender goodwill does not work with evil, and these people are evil. Recognizing evil, not appeasing, and ultimately for Jews, it's realizing that we should never rely upon anyone else. Because the world stood silent, because half of the world were Hitler's willing executioners, and the other half stood silent when they could have done even the smallest of things to prevent massive scales, let alone, you know, not take in 6 million Jews, open the gates of Palestine, which isn't even yours, a little political fallout, bomb the lines to Auschwitz. Tommy Lapid, Yair Lapid's father, famous story, he's flying over Texas. He's flying over Texas, and he looks down for however many, an hour it takes to fly over Texas, and he says, this is why we need Israel. Why? Here's an empty state, vast expanses of empty land. Could have stuck 6 million Jews in there, it wouldn't have made a difference. And that's why we need Israel. So never rely upon anyone else. Never say, oh, we'll create a buffer zone, we'll put troops between you, we'll be the monitoring stations. It's all hogwash. Okay? From the 1950s, next week we'll learn about the 1956 Sinai campaign. They put the UN in, don't worry, Israel. The Egyptians just kicked them all out. The world didn't react, and that's what happened. Yom Kippur War, buffer zone. They moved in the troops, world doesn't do anything. So those are the lessons for me. Appeasement doesn't work. Evil is evil and will not stop. And don't rely upon anyone but ourselves. Those are the lessons. Yeah.
I get nervous about defining evil as a thing. I'm wondering how it can be.
It's not a thing. It's people who are evil. People who embody evil. Now, there are people who are good-meaning and misplaced. There are people who are bystanders, not willing to stick their necks out. That's not evil. There are people who are even just greedy. That's not evil. But people who are, I mean, you know, Nazi Germany, they were sociopaths on a national level, right, to do this. You see the same things exhibited in Iran leadership, okay? From the open statements to dehumanize and demonize Jews, which you see, by the way, all over in the Egyptian press as well, you know, which is the first step to their explicit statements that they want to wipe out and incinerate Israel. If someone is saying they're going to wipe you out and they're arming themselves, you take them seriously. There's a professor who did a whole typological analysis of genocide. There are 9 steps to genocide. One is they say they're going to do it, and they do it. And he said, usually when they say they're going to do it, They do it. They try to do it. So, it's not a thing, it's people, unfortunately. And evil is very, it's a different category. In Jewish law is something that's called a rasha, evil person. This evil person, Hitler said, Jews gave the world two scourges, circumcision and conscience. He was making war against God. That is evil. Right? And Iran that sponsors Hezbollah and terrorism and killing of civilians and using their own children as cannon fodder in the Iran-Iraq war. So these people are. So that is evil. Is it the whole Iranian people? Maybe not. Probably not. And we can discuss it next week. I mean, it's very scary when 75% of the Gaza population says that they believe in suicide bombers killing civilians. That's not the leadership. That's the majority of the population. So sometimes it's leadership. Unfortunately, sometimes it's the majority of the population. So, that's evil. It's a culture of death and darkness. Talk about it more next week, unfortunately. Any other questions? Getting late here. Yeah.
Why we are as Jewish, we are like every new generation something bad happened.
I went through the whole history of medieval anti-Semitism. Why anti-Semitism? It's really for a whole other discussion on anti-Semitism and then on theology, which we're not ready to do tonight. But I think just one hint of what I just said. People understand that Jews brought a message of morality to the world, of might doesn't make right, of every human being has equal rights and equal value before the law. And there's a very ambivalent attitude towards that in the world. They resent us for it. Sometimes it's jealousy, but it's not mainly jealousy. Jews are educated, more driven, and we succeed. It's not mainly that. There's a scapegoat theory. There are many different theories of anti-Semitism, but I think that that's starting to go in the direction of how we understand this. Okay. Thank you for indulging, and I hope this has been meaningful, and I kind of made the disclaimer at the beginning that the Holocaust is really a topic we cannot explain, cannot grasp, but one can look at it, and there's some lessons to be learned from it, some insights to have into it, but as Elie Wiesel told us on Sunday, it just defies all logic.